Welcome to the Big Beatles Sort Out. In the first series, I, author and musician Gary Abbott, ranked all the Beatles' core catalogue releases with the help of my Beatles expert brother Paul. In series two, we worked our way through an assortment of added Beatles goodies, such as Live at the BBC, the anthology series, and the movies. And now for series three, we're looking at all the post-Beatles singles released in the decade following their breakup. As with series one, we take five songs in random order each week and score them for music, production and lyrics to find the best post-Beatles Beatles hits. Thanks for joining us as we try and sort out the Beatles. Welcome to series three, episode 11. And welcome to our roaming reporter, Paul Abbott, for this special bonus episode. Hello, roaming reporter Paul Abbott.
Roaming. It's normally roving reporter, I think.
Know, you're not
roaming
when I say
makes it
wrong.
Seem a lot more like I'm just going around, like yeah. Just trying anywhere, hoping yeah. to find some Beatles people.
I guess, in fact, you were the opposite, really. But I'll let you explain that in a little while. Mm-hmm. First, let's do the usual. Don't forget, you can keep in touch with us at big_sort on Twitter and Instagram or by email to bigbeatlessortout@gmail.com. And please drop us a review on whatever platform you're listening on if you can, and like and share our posts. And thank you to people who have reviewed us recently. We've had some new ones. Very nice. As always, thank you. And please check the episode description for any links we put up there. We have other things we do too, our own music and whatnot. So, Paul, yes, you weren't really roving or roaming. You were very much...
No, I knew exactly where I was and what I was doing.
In one place. Do you want to tell us, and our good listeners, what to expect from this bonus episode that we've got this week?
So basically, what we've got here is a very different episode of the show, because we got the opportunity to partner up with the Institute of Popular Music, the Music Department at University of Liverpool, and Liverpool University Press, to take part in a small event featuring one of the contributors to the brand new Journal of Beatles Studies, which I have mentioned several times before on this very podcast. And essentially what happened was that Cass Sunstein was over in the UK to talk to some people in the law school at the University of Liverpool, and he's one of the contributors to the journal, and so the music department, the Institute of Popular Music, snared him for their own nefarious ends, and I was asked to take part in it as well. So what we've got coming up here is we've got Dr. Holly Tesler, who runs the Beatles MA at the University of Liverpool. Just a side note, on the day we recorded this, she'd been at the December graduation for the first graduating cohort of students from the Beatles MA.
Oh, brilliant.
Which was brilliant, and they gave her a very good Beatles-themed cake.
Right.
So maybe she'll share a picture of that on the social media as well. And it was, so it was a really nice thing to be doing. It's nice to be asked. It was a nice thing to be doing on that particular day as well. Mm-hmm. So the first thing you'll hear is you'll hear Holly talking to Cass Sunstein about his article in the Journal of Beatles Studies.
Right.
And then I take over. Basically, it goes to our sort of thing. Five songs, and it's Cass's Desert Island McCartney songs, to tie in with a feature in the journal about McCartney 80 at 80, sort of the selection of the sort of editors of the journal picked a load of songs. So we've tied into that notion there, mm-hmm. and gave Cass Sunstein the opportunity to pick his five Desert Island McCartney songs. And it was a very interesting selection from a very different perspective to you and I talking.
Yes.
With our backgrounds and similarities and, you know, geographical location, etc. So you've got a bit of academic discussion. Then you've got a bit of a sort of sideways version of the Big Beatles Sort Out with me and Cass Sunstein. And then after that, me and you will have a little chat about what you chose.
Yeah, that sounds good.
So if you want to read the articles within the Journal of Beatles Studies, then it is an open access journal, which means it's available freely online. So if you simply search in Google for Journal of Beatles Studies, the first link you'll see pop up is Liverpool University Press. And through that, you'll be able to access all the various articles within the journal that I've talked about before and mentioned. And, and obviously, it's an academic journal, so it might be a different thing to what you've read about the Beatles before. But, it, you know, that's just an example of the range of the types of writing about the Beatles and a lot of different voices you may not have come across. So do that. I've got my own physical copy from the sort of special... They did a short run of paperback versions for the first edition of this thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, anyone can go and read it. get onto Liverpool University Press and check it out. So, yes, thank you to Holly Tesler for asking me to be involved in the event. Thank you to Liverpool University Press for helping put it on and promote it and basically get this Journal of Beatles Studies launched. Thank you to Cass Sunstein for letting me grill him about his McCartney choices. And thank you to everyone who came along to the event on the day. It was a nice way to spend an afternoon. Shall we have a listen?
Let's do it.
All right, well, hello, everyone. Thank you guys all so much for coming. It is an absolute delight for you to be here. I'm sort of wearing two hats today. My first hat is I'm here as the program leader for the Beatles MA, which is officially called the MA Beatles Music Industry and Heritage. And today is a particularly happy day because this morning we just graduated our first cohort of students. And in my second hat, I am here as the co-editor of the Journal of Beatles Studies, published by Liverpool University Press. And I'm very delighted to introduce one of the contributors to our first edition, which came out just a couple of months ago. This is Professor Cass Sunstein. He is an American legal scholar at Harvard University, is known for his studies of constitutional and administrative law, environmental law, law and behavioral economics. He is also a New York Times best-selling author of The World According to Star Wars and Nudge. So in addition to all of his legal and environmental work, Cass is also a Beatles fan. So when we were putting the first issue of the Journal of Beatles Studies together about a year ago, this time I got an email from Cass, and it said something along the lines of, I know I've missed the deadline, but could I maybe make a contribution to the journal? And I sort of went, well, yes. Yes, you can, please. So here we are, fast forward a year. We had the first issue of the journal out, and Cass's contribution is called Beatlemania, an informational cascades and spectacular success. So what I figure we'll do today is do a couple of different things. We'll talk about the Beatles, as we've been already doing, but we'll do it, open up a little bit more formally. We'll then talk about Cass's article and this concept of informational cascades. I'd also like to introduce Paul Abbott. Paul is a graduate of the Department of Music, but he is here also wearing another hat. He hosts a podcast with his brother, Gary, called The Big Beatles Sort Out. Since starting this Beatles MA, I've been working very hard to try to join up all of the exciting Beatles stuff happening in and around Liverpool. And Paul's podcast is this season, which is series 3, looking at solo songs of the Beatles after the breakup, which conveniently fits in with something else from the journal, which we did to commemorate Paul McCartney's 80th birthday, which was just this past June, where we did an 80 at 80 playlist of so. Each of the editorial board members chose 20 songs. There were four of us. So we came up with a playlist of 80 songs, which you could find through Spotify, or there's a QR code that you could scan with your phone and take a listen to it. And so what we've asked Cass to do to tie everything together is for Cass to come up with his top five Paul McCartney solo songs. And sort of I'll hand over to Paul, and we'll talk through Cass's selections of Paul McCartney songs. So please do join me in welcoming Cass to our event today. So, you must be a Beatles fan.
Big time. With enthusiasm.
All right, so how did you become a Beatles fan?
It started when I was in my teens. The first record I got was Revolver, which is the best of all the Beatles albums, don't argue. Serendipitously, Revolver, the very best, was the first record I owned. And there was something about the effervescence, the sense of life, the humor, the wit, and also the emotion that got to teenage yours truly. So is there a love song that has more of a sense of nostalgia and menace than Norwegian Wood? It has nostalgia and it has menace in it, doesn't it? About risk and loss and promise. Is there a song about the rapture of love that's better than I've just seen a face? Is there one that beats that? It's hard to say that there is. And so to be struck by, I'm just having singly to here, there, and everywhere think Paul believes that's the best song he's ever written. It's extremely beautiful. It's not the best song on Revolver or on Rubber Soul, which I got in short order after that. And this is just an amazing period of lots of stuff.
You will provoke a lot of opinions if you start asking people favorite Beatles songs right. and favorite Beatles albums and right. which are their preferences. But you've obviously stated a preference for sort of that middle period. And it's quite funny. In this job, I've been asked quite a number of times, what are your favorite Beatles songs? And you identify the two I tend to say, wow. which is I've Just Seen a Face in Norwegian wow. Wood, which, wow. of course, I always say this too, that on the American version of Rubber Soul, yeah. it's a 1-2 punch. Yeah. And I think it's probably the best 1-2 punch in pop music. But
yeah, I agree.
So what motivated you to sort of make the leap? Because this is the first time you've published on the Beatles.
Yeah. Well, I saw that you had created this journal. And at the time, I was starting doing some academic work after a full-time year in the Biden administration. I'm still associated with the Biden administration, but I have an arrangement now where I'm permitted to write. And when I saw what you had done, I thought, this is fabulous and historic, and the Beatles are a lens onto so much about culture and history and the human spirit. And so I thought this was exciting if I was up to it. And I wrote you a note. I had an idea that actually was connected with Norwegian Wood that didn't pan out, but you kindly indicated you'd let me try. And then when that didn't work out because it involved knowledge of music that I didn't have, so I had to back off in recognition of my own limitations, I thought there was something that I had actually written a little bit about, not in an academic way, but in a more journalistic way, about the rise of the Beatles. And so I knew a little bit about that, and that seemed to me fascinating and was connected with issues I've been kind of obsessed by for a long time, which is about the sources of cultural success and failure. Why is William Blake now part of the canon in poetry when for many years he was unknown? Why is Jane Austen now Jane Austen? Well, when she was alive, she was not like that. So how does that happen? And so to think about that in connection with the Beatles in our time, I think this is endlessly interesting and gets to deep issues about memory and presentism, contemporary needs mapped onto things that happened maybe decades ago, and also the enduringness or not of talent. And the movie, which I love, Yesterday, has a bold thesis, which is that whenever you hear the Beatles, it's going to go wild because they're so great. And I want that thesis to be true, but I don't believe that it's true.
Yeah, it's so interesting to hear you say that, because within the Beatles MA, one of the things I challenge them to do is think about the question of how do we know what we know about the Beatles? And how does that change over time? And certainly in recent times, a big talking point in Beatles studies is the Get Back film that came out last year. Tells a very different story and a very different narrative to the original Let It Be film that was filmed and released in 1970. So it's exactly that. You can apply the same sort of logic to William Blake, to the Mona Lisa, to the Beatles, to anything really. It's as we get further along, there's all sorts of recontextualization that goes on and different thinking. We talk about the passing of the Queen in much the same sense, that we're starting to see these sort of fictional histories emerging about fairly recent history that many people have lived through. But for younger people, they're watching the Netflix series and thinking that's how it must have happened. And that has bigger implications for where the Beatles go in future, because we're passing through this era of lived history into people who come across the Beatles on Spotify or come across the Beatles on Twitter. And their Twitter, Beatles Twitter, is a weird and wonderful place where if any of you have seen it, there's something called the Teatles, for example. Wow. People obsessed with Beatles and photos of the Beatles with cups of tea. There's also the Boodles, obsessed with Beatles footwear. And what we're seeing is that, as one we were just talking about, one of the other articles in the journal by Steve Jones and Walter Podrazik talks about the fact that people are nowadays in an era of social media interacting with the narrative of the Beatles, not necessarily in a structure, in an organized, this is how it started, this is 1962, and this is how they broke up, but in these little snippets. Somebody points out something on Twitter, and somebody takes that factoid, completely devoid of context, and then applies it. And when you see history and understand history that way, it becomes very different. It's interesting to see how you can see the Beatles in relation to that idea.
Okay, so there's a lot in what you said. So one possibility is there are facts of the matter that are overridden by contemporary something. So there's a distortion. So there might be a view at some point that, forgive me, Ringo, I'm going to describe this as counterfactual, that Ringo actually wrote all of the Beatles' best songs. You could imagine that being thought, and that would be, let's say, false. Not because his songs aren't good, they're very good, they're underrated, but because he didn't write, for example, Norwegian Wood and I've Just Seen a Face. He didn't write those songs. So you could imagine a false view that he wrote those songs. So that would be one thing that could happen, misinformation. Another thing that could happen that is happening, I think, though it's hard for us to see it, is that the conception of the Beatles might be true, but there are five others that are true, and we're emphasizing one. So our understanding of the Beatles might be, I'm just going to make one up, that they were the relative good boys of rock music. They were well-behaved and not revolutionaries in any sense, maybe musically, but not in any cultural or political way. And the Rolling Stones were, et cetera. And that's the account. Now, there's a competing account that I say is not historically less plausible, which is that you would know, I'm an amateur here, but that the Beatles had much more rebelliousness and cultural innovation of a political sort than we have recognized and than we generally recognize. So the Beatles are a little like Martin Luther King in the United States. I'm venturing this, where Martin Luther King is regarded as, everyone likes Martin Luther King. He was in favor of the Constitution. Well, Martin Luther King was a very polarizing person in his time. He was not someone who everyone liked. He had a lot of stuff going on that was not just, all we are saying is give peace a chance in a way that's very simple. And so there's a conception of the Beatles, and it's probably been written up, maybe you wrote it up, and I'm sure you're aware of it, which sees the Beatles as much more culturally novel and counter than they are currently conceived. I suggest that's interesting, and that's not false to the facts. The good boy view is also interesting and not false to the facts. So these are different conceptions which are consistent with the facts and underdetermined by them. And then the conception of the Beatles that we have would be presentist. And that tells us something about culture.
It does. It does indeed. And it can be so provocative about, again, I refer back to social media where somebody will say something and there's always, on social media, there's always an opposing view, isn't there? Somebody will say, I love John Lennon. Yeah, but he was horrible to Yoko. And that sparks a whole controversy of interpretation and attack and counterattack. So it is all of these ways of understanding culture. It's fluid and we have to understand that. And there is what we can see clearly is an emerging evolution in the way younger fans are perceiving and interacting with the Beatles than those who lived through it and were first generation fans.
And which is right, you know, the current understanding of Blake has a lot more in it than the contemporaneous, basically, who was that?
Yeah, it's exactly so. And it is all about this idea of not just understanding the music. You can hear the music and you either like it or you don't like it. But it's the story around the Beatles and the story about the songs that will draw you in and make you a fan or turn you off and not make you a fan.
Okay, so I'm thinking as you talk that the link between what you work on and constitutional law is actually tighter than might appear. So there's a constitutional idea. It can be, you know, in a formal constitution, as in Germany or Ireland or the United States, or it could be constitutional small c, but its understanding is variable. So what liberty means and how ought we to understand its cultural variance, and, you know, there's retrogression and progress, and it might be static is best, and these all replicate in understandings of the Beatles.
They do indeed. I think we should come on to your article here. I should mention, too, that the Journal of Beatles Studies is in its primary form an open access journal, which is available through the university, the Liverpool University Press website. So if you haven't taken a look, you can. If you this just because it's our inaugural issue, we have a print version available for sale through the LUP website as well, if you haven't gotten one. Cass's article is here, and it's titled Beatlemania on Informational Cascades and Spectacular Success. Let's start with Beatlemania, then. Of course, we all think we understand what Beatlemania is this idea of people who were rabid fans of the Beatles. But unpack that a little bit, and one of the interesting things emerging in contemporary Beatles studies is that perhaps a gendered term? Is a mania, a Beatle hysteria, or should it be something a little bit more gender neutral, like a Beatles euphoria?
Okay, let's talk about the mechanisms and then the gender issue. So there's something called tulip mania, which is about a craze for tulips, which involve economic investments. And the notion of tulip mania is consistent with social science literature on manias, which are understood as processes of social influences by which one person listens to another person. Then there's a third person in a kind of temporal cue who's listened to the first two. And then the fourth, who's heard the first three, is adding a volume of enthusiasm or the opposite to a signal, which is getting louder and louder. And that can be responsible for Taylor Swift's massive popularity. I think it is. Taylor Swift is the product of a mania, and I'm trying to give micro foundations building on the shoulders of giants, which is an informational cascade. And so one understanding of Beatlemania is that it's just an informational cascade, which is not to say they're not amazing, but there are a lot of amazing groups, maybe not as amazing as the Beatles, who didn't even keep going as groups because they didn't benefit from an informational cascade. That seems like a very jarring thought, and I hate the fact that I said it, but because it is not consistent with intuition. We like to think in terms of causal accounts by which what happened inevitably happened, but history is only run once, which means you can't see the counterfactuals. The fact is that in Liverpool, people amplified the signal that was given by their predecessors to a point where there was a mania. And that happens with Barack Obama. It happened with Donald Trump. They were both beneficiaries of informational cascades. And it happens with Stephen King. And it happens with Emma Thompson. So it's all over culture and politics. Now, I just for myself, I think the word mania builds on an established understanding of mechanisms and micro foundations of the Arab Spring or the fall of communism or the rise of fascism. These are similar dynamics, notwithstanding the radically different domains. And so I think the word mania is fine. would you say that the people who loved Obama were gendered female in some way? I don't know even how to think about that. I was part of that campaign. I'd say lots of men and lots of women were effectively Obama mania. And it meant there was an informational signal. It obviously had emotional components, and we can talk about that. I think this is just about social interactions. It can be something horrifying like Mussolini, or something fantastic like the fact that Charles Dickens, there's Dickens mania. Hooray.
Yeah, it's funny that you mention Obama, because in one of the earliest bits of research I did on the Beatles and storytelling, I remember the Obama campaign, and he was one of the first modern politicians to really lean into this idea of storytelling, that he would talk about his mother dying, and he would tell stories about growing up in Chicago, and he was relatable. And he was and of course, as the first Black African-American candidate, he had a lot of convincing of a lot of segments of America to do. And he did that through narrative and all that we're talking about, this idea of how does that vibe, that hype start, of what you call informational cascades. So to see that happening with the Beatles successively in each generation, some of it's received wisdom. Parents will tell their kids, and sometimes it'll be an anti-rebellion sort of idea of, oh, why would you like them? Oh, but I love them. And sometimes younger people will come to the Beatles in their own way. My colleague Mike and I spoke to a potential applicant last year. She's a fan of George Harrison and Harry Styles, wow. And she sees them as contemporaries. And I find that absolutely fascinating. Yeah. Again, just that you could see someone who's of the age immediately and contemporarily popular with an act that was born 50 years before she was, 60 years. To see all of that and understand it in terms of fandom, you've come up with a concept called informational cascades, which you alluded to already. But would you be okay to say a little bit more about that?
Okay, so suppose that those of us in this room are deciding what book to read next. And let's suppose that the first person is Connor, my friend, who's in the room. And Connor says we should read the new novel by Stephen King. Let's suppose I'm the second in the queue, and I both think Stephen King is very good and trust Connor, as I do. And so I'm kind of in equipoise about what this group should read next, but I say, okay, Stephen King's new novel. And then Holly might, unless she has strong convictions, go along with Connor and Cass, not because she necessarily thinks the two of us are right, but because there's an informational signal given by the two of us. Now, once Connor and Cass and Holly all say, let's read the new Stephen King novel, Paul would have to have either a lot of private information suggesting the novel's terrible, or a strong conviction that there's something else that we ought to read, or just be a disagreeable type, which he seems not to be, to buck the emerging group trend. Now, this is very stylized and simple, but this is how manias often arise. Now, there's more going on than informational signal. There might be also a reputational cascade, where it might be that if three predecessors have said, let's read Stephen King, and Paul says, no, I want to read the dictionary instead, the signal he's giving is that he's kind of boring, and he wants to read dictionaries, and he might actually want to read dictionaries, but he's giving a signal that he knows Connor, at least. I like reading dictionaries too, I hasten to add. But he might not want to incur Connor's disapproval. And so with the Beatles' popularity, there's an informational cascade. I saw it as a very young person in the United States. I saw everyone talking about, have you heard the Beatles? And if you said no, that would be a very bad signal. And if you said, yes, I've heard them and I'm not sure if I like them, that would be like saying, let's read the dictionary. So the informational pressure and reputational pressure. And for the Beatles were the beneficiaries relatively late. You're again the expert on this, but they, you know, played a ton and had amazing almost success before they became Rockets. And the Rockets were like what happened when communism fell. Really, it was the same dynamic of someone said after communism fell, someone in Hungary, I think, said, last year, everyone liked communism. This year, no one likes communism. And that was both about the information and the reputational pressure. And so the Beatles, like Star Wars, this was something that everyone knew about, and everyone either did like, in this case, basically everyone did like, because they were so great, or said they liked, even if they weren't sure, because you'd better.
It's fascinating. I'm just trying to process it all, because I'm thinking about the role of technology in informational cascades, because in the 1960s, all of this is word of mouth, and there are very centralized hubs of where you go to get information about popular culture. It's very easy to forget about in our 21st century lives where everything is connected by mobile phones and we can see everything and hear everything we want in an instant. But then you had to wait for a publication to come out, or you had to go somewhere if your town didn't have a record shop to get a particular record. Today, informational cascades might be akin to social media influencers. And of course, that leads us down a pathway to things like algorithms. And if you like this, maybe you like that. And when you go onto Amazon, you bought this. What about that? So what is the role of technology in informational cascades?
So, making a great point. In the Beatles' time, many of you will know that they had real struggle getting a record deal. And their manager tried repeatedly and failed. And George Martin, you know, the fifth Beatle, as he's sometimes described, said no, said that they're not that good. And Brian Epstein had to get some people who worked with George Martin to be enthusiasts after the original failure to get George Martin to give Love Me Do a chance. And then there was a record, Love Me Do. You'll know more about this than I do, but I do know a little bit. And then it was here in Liverpool where they had a fan base. And that fan base was a product of an informational cascade. So I have to say it's, you know, Liverpool, this is my first time. It's completely amazing to be here. This is exactly where the existence of the fan base made the Beatles possible. Now, the fan base wasn't random. The Beatles were good and they played. But if people hadn't bought that record, who knows what would have happened?
Yeah, you talk about that in the sort of final section of your article, and you call it the Lost Einsteins, which is always sort of what might have been. And it very much parallels that film Yesterday that you were talking about. So what do you mean by this idea of Lost Einsteins?
Okay, so this is the kind of the insufficiently developed holy grail in my article, meaning I didn't find it, but I know it's out there, the holy grail. And here's a way to look at it. As amazing as all four are, and I'll just signal Paul and John as to say they're off the charts is inadequate, it would be startling if the only people who were as off the charts as they in the last 70 years were in this city at that time. That's just too miraculous. So there's South Africa, and there's Colombia, and there's Italy. And isn't there some place where there were people as good as they were? And what happened to them? So the suggestion is that it just has to be of the billions of people, there were people as talented. And I say this with fear and trembling because the emotional part of my brain doesn't believe there's anyone who is as talented as those two or talented the way those two are. But the less emotional part of my brain says, emotional part of Cass's brain, you were being completely ridiculous. Just the numbers can't make that possible. So what happened to them? What either happened to them was they didn't meet, or they got poor at a certain time, or they got discouraged or impatient at a certain time, and so they went and did something else, and we never heard of them. But they were incredible. And if you read science fiction, there's a counterfactual world in which there are Lennon and McCartneys, whom everybody in this room knows about, from, let's say, Dublin. And they were there right at the same time as the Beatles. And they're called the Whatevers. And they are recognized in that counterfactual world. These are the two equals. And the Rolling Stones a little bit behind. And in terms of talent, it just has to be true statistically that that's so. Now that's, I think, thrilling, because it suggests all around us there are potential. And let's have them come to the university and see what happens with them. And what they're amazing at, who knows? It also suggests the flip side. With a little this or a little that, the Beatles wouldn't have made it. Now, if they hadn't X or Y or Z, and you can fill in that blank, would they have made it? Unclear. Paul and John said at an early stage, the period where they couldn't get a record deal, you know, we're about to give up.
And what you touch on, the most powerful question you can ask in fandom is what if? What if this were to happen? What if that hadn't happened? And one of the most eye-opening, since starting this degree, one of the most eye-opening areas I've come across is Beatles online fan fiction, which is a world unto itself. But it's you know, as it would be in Star Wars or any other sort of fan-created universe, what happens if that happens? So what would happen if John Lennon had lived, or if the Beatles didn't break up? And it goes down some surprising rabbit holes, some eye-opening rabbit holes at that, if anybody is a fan of fan fiction.
And one question on so the lost McCartney and Lennons, that's a, that's certainly true. Now, are they exactly like them? Definitely not. Are they as good as they? I hate to say it, but yes, and we never heard them. Where are they? Maybe they're lawyers now. A terrible thought. But also, the what if question, I think, has cultural and sociological interest. What if Paul and John hadn't met on that day? Then what would have happened? Would they have met on some other day?
Yeah, you say, would we have a Kinks mania instead of a Beatles mania if that hadn't happened? It does make your head start to spin with the question of what could have been or what might have been or how close we came to things not panning out. It becomes very philosophical, doesn't it?
Okay, so with your indulgence, I'll give you an example of the Lennon and McCartney of social science. There's a guy named Daniel Kahneman, who was at Princeton for many years, and a guy named Amos Tversky, who was at Stanford for many years. They invented kind of modern behavioral science, and they've been referred to as the Lennon and McCartney of behavioral science, of social science. They might not have met, and they collaborated for 12 years, and that might not have happened. Then what? I mean, intellectual life would be really different all over the world.
It's absolutely fascinating. I am keeping an eye on the time because I want to allow a little bit of lighthearted entertainment now, which is to hand over to Paul and shift guests. I do apologize for the sudden gear shift, but one of the things we've invited Paul along to do is talk to you not about the heavy academic writing, but the lighthearted Beatles fandom. And again, when you study the Beatles, it's always there. You have to sort of park the academic side from the fan side of your brain. But what we've asked you to do is come up with a Desert Island Discs of your top five Paul McCartney solo songs. So maybe, Paul, if I hand over to you, you could say a bit about the podcast and the series, and then you and Cass could have a chat about his Paul McCartney selections.
Yeah, my name's Paul, and as Holly said, I do a podcast with my brother, who can't be here today. He's in Stoke, that far away. He apologises he can't be here. He'd love to be. Basically, the podcast started during lockdown, as 8 billion other podcasts did. I was already doing a couple, and then my brother said, I'm going to do a Beatles one, and I said, not without me, you're not. So essentially what the initial format was, he was like, I'm just going to rate them. I'm going to rank them all. So he decided, I'm going to do 5 random picks out of the bag, look at the music, look at the lyrics, look at production, and I was going to go along with him, give him facts and figures, and tell him that everything he was doing was wrong, basically. But no, it was great. It was a lot of fun, and we did it for a couple of years, and this year, as we're on Series 3, which is essentially the 1970s, to do that, so, which is a bit different indeed. So it's nice that this ties into the notion of some solo McCartney stuff and this celebration of him at 80. The Desert Island Discs format's good because Desert Island Discs turned 80 this year as well. It's slightly older than Paul McCartney Desert Island Discs. I mean, I won't ask you for choices of the books and luxuries that you'd have on a desert island. I don't know what the Beatles book that would be the equivalent of the Bible. Perhaps when Lewison finishes all of that thing, that'll be the Beatles Bible one. And the last time I was studying at Lecture Theatre in the Rendell Building, I was delivering a presentation for topics in the history of popular music for my MA, where I was talking about the British invasion and how annoying Dave Clark is. So it's an interesting selection. Thank you for sending them across. Because you have an American perspective on this, and you probably have experience with a slightly different selection of song selection and what songs were plugged more in America to the UK. There's a little bit of variance in the solo Beatles catalogue in terms of what becomes the lead single in America. And actually, 2 or 3 of the ones you've chosen here have slightly different, or they're seen differently in America. And so you'll be able to hopefully tell me a little bit about which version you know better on some of these. The way I've organised it from your list you sent through, I've gone from earliest to latest, and everyone will know these ones, but it's really interesting to hear what people choose when you've got this much stuff to choose from. I'll start at the beginning, and I'll start with Maybe I'm Amazed, which of course is on an album in the UK. Well, it's on an album everywhere, but it comes out as a live single as well in America. So I'm wondering what version you know best. Do you know the McCartney album version, or do you know the single version, the live version at all?
The live single.
So the live one.
Yeah.
Okay. That was interesting because I barely know this live. Has anyone heard that live version of Maybe I'm Amazed? So the album comes out in 1970. This live single tied into Wings Over America comes out in 1977. And it's much slower. It's much slower. It's great. It's a great performance, but it's much slower. And just before we talk a bit more, I'll play a little. See if you can spot in the edit where it cuts to the live version. Spotted the subtle change partway through that there. So why Maybe I'm Amazed live version then?
Paul is probably the most versatile pop musician in memory. And the range of things he can do often makes it hard to isolate what's most, so to speak, amazing about any particular. Paul is so skilled, and so it's like his musical fingers are like they're so dexterous that for him to show deep emotion isn't usual. He's often having fun and playing, and this one has deep emotion in it. You could hear it there, not only in the whiff of plaintiveness in Maybe I'm Amazed, but also the high-pitched, almost keening part. Not there, he's too great a singer to keen, but there's a where he, the feeling of being amazed by things working out in the way they did for him, it completely comes across. And even that little musical bridge you had has joy and delight and kind of surprise in it.
Yes.
So it's, I think it's a genius song, and it's uncharacteristic for Paul. I think in its, it has rawness in it.
Well, I would say yes. I have the word raw written down here, in fact. And I think actually this selection goes from raw to quite smooth by the end of it. I think you're right. It's interesting because it's obviously a song that comes straight off the back of the Beatles' breakup and him trying to put things back together. And the way he does it is generally go and make music. And so that's what he does. And obviously the record is, other than Linda adding a few harmonies, is just him, you know, his happy place is given 8 or 16 tracks and a piano and a load of instruments and he can do anything. And this is a song that's born out of that, definitely. And this is a song that he's played, I think, probably in every live show he's done. It's definitely like 550 gigs where this song has been performed to this day. And you mentioned about his singing on it, about how high he goes. And he perhaps is struggling a little bit with those high notes now. But I think because this song means so much to him, I think that's why it stays in the set. And obviously now he's reflecting back on Linda. Yeah, so was this a single you remember coming out at the time? Was it the live version?
Yes, I remember it. And what I remember is, you know, when the Beatles broke up, there was a sense of loss. So in a way, what the song did for the audience was consistent with what it was transmitting and kind of doing for the singer.
Yeah.
So the when I hear the song, I think about love, and that's what the song's kind of about. But also, it's like a speech act for the audience and the listeners. And I remember it in real time that we still have this, and you know, Paul's doing this.
Yes.
So it had a feeling of, terrible word, affirming of what was continuing in the face of what was a international grief that the Beatles breaking up.
Yeah.
Thank you, Paul. Both Pauls. Thank you, Paul. And Paul.
Yeah, it's fascinating because, that single, live single does come out, but it makes much less impact over here. I think people would generally know the album version. Over here, it got to number 28 in the charts. In America, it gets to number 10 and spends 13 weeks in the charts. So it's, you know, not a mega, mega hit, but for a live song, off a live album as just sort of a bit of a sales pitch for the album. Yeah, it does very, very well indeed.
And I say the fact that it did super well in the US and not so much here, it's serendipity. That there's nothing in the culture, it's kind of marketing, it caught on, there was a cascade.
Yeah.
And it could have been just reversed.
Excellent. Okay, so we'll move on to about a year from the original recording of Maybe I'm Amazed to something slightly different, which is Uncle Albert, Admiral Halsey, which, again, if you're going to pick a song that represents a certain type of McCartney music, you can't really do worse than this one. So we'll have a little snippet of this because it's wonderful.
We're so sorry, Uncle Albert. We're so sorry if we caused you any pain. We're so sorry, Albert, but there's no one left at home, and I believe I'm gonna wake. Admiral Halsey notified me he had to have a bath or he couldn't get to sea. I had another look and I had a cup of tea and a butter pie.
Butter pie?
The butter wouldn't melt, so I put it in the pie.
Oh, all right.
Stop it there after a phrase which I'm pretty sure 90% of people listening to don't have a clue what he's going on about. But yeah, so this was only a single in America, never came out as a single in the UK. Funny thing is, the big singles box set that McCartney did recently means that this has just had a big remaster in the mono edition, so you can listen to as well. He records it in America as well, as most of the stuff on RAM was anyway, and it becomes a number one, which is kind of unbelievable because it's such a weird song. It's one I absolutely love it, but What does it mean to you? What is Uncle Albert and Admiral Halsey to you?
Well, I think this is Paul McCartney's Ulysses. So if you read Ulysses, there's one thing in one style and another thing in another style, and some of it's really serious and some of it's stylized and some of it's a little saccharine and some of it's, you know, heartfelt, and it's all over the place. And this is all over the place. I think what makes it, the reason I love it, is its effervescence and sense of mischief. And also, you can tell, it has a little touch of Yeats, where McCartney is just his own dexterity and talent just pouring out. And you can see there's a poem by Yeats, The Fiddler of Dooney, which is really the fiddler says he's the one who first gets into heaven, not the other ones, it's the fiddler, because people like a fiddler. And this reminds me, which is, it's kind of arrogant for Yeats to say, I'm the one who gets into heaven first, and a fiddler's like a poet, so this is not just about fiddlers, it's about art and music. And this is, this has the variety of diversity for a song that is Joycean, and it has the delight in his own amazingness. You can see he's a little bit stunned by what he's able to do. And so what it means, I don't know, but how it feels, I do know, which is life is great and there's a lot of stuff in it.
Yeah, brilliant. That's the most, I would never have thought of Uncle Albert as the most literary McCartney song, but you could well be right. It's a classic example of his bit-by-bit approach that he has, you know, throughout his career. He likes sticking bits together. And sometimes they're quite obviously medleys, and he calls them one song into another. And some are one song made up of bits, and this is one of those ones, which seems to work really well here. And it's got sort of the character-based vignettes, so, you know, the Eleanor Rigby tradition carries on. And it's also got his own lifestyle in there, so the hands across the water bit is very much Linda's American, I'm British, we're together. The butter pie line, which is... Have we got time to talk about butter pies? Probably not. But apparently McCartney's version of it is a vegetarian meal he made for Christmas or Thanksgiving or something themselves, like a cold macaroni thing, not a butter pie like we have up north here. But it's fascinating. It's got everything in there. One of the good things, of course, is the lyrics book came out last year. Yes. And so there's a lot of re-justification for some of these things. He approaches them in different ways. And that's Uncle Albert, Admiral Halsey. It's a wonderful thing. Well, let's move on again another couple of years forward to Live and Let Die. So, question. Have you seen Paul live?
Seen Paul live. Terrible.
Who's seen Paul live here?
I'm not here, but...
Well, I mean, in this room. only a handful of people. Well, everyone who has seen him live will have seen Live and Let Die.
I have a collection of videos of that performance live on my phone if anybody wants to see it afterwards, because it's the showstopper event, isn't
wow.
it?
Yeah, it's a phenomenal song. So it's another one that he's played more or less all the way through his career. And I will just, before I ask you about it, say the first time I've seen him a couple of times, and the first time I saw him in Liverpool, you'll have seen probably the videos of the pyrotechnics and stuff like that. And one of the stagehands comes out and puts a wet towel over all the guitar pedals, because they're so close to the front of the stage. And that first Liverpool show I saw, which is a Christmas one, actually, just after all the pyrotechnics, the song had finished, you could see Paul, he just kept saying, it's too hot. It's obviously something that someone hadn't quite put the distance. It's too hot. So, you know, he risks a lot coming on stage to do these things for you. I'm presuming you've seen the film of Live and Let Die.
Yes.
Yeah. Are you a Bond fan?
Yes, not as much as I am a Beatles fan, but I like Bond.
Yes. Yeah. So it's a good combo, McCartney doing a song like this and that sort of action-adventure. So Live and Let Die, then, what is it about this one?
It has a little bit of the energy of Helter Skelter, which is one of my favorites. It's less wild, but it has demonic energy, which Paul isn't, that's not his standard thing, but he gets there with this one. And... it kind of suits a different kind of rocky mood than the others we've talked about. And it's kind of perfect for that. So it's a showstopper, even if you just play it at home. And that's what makes it great. And it shows Paul can do that.
Let's have a little bit of it. Great George Martin orchestration on it as well. Nominated for the Oscar for Best Song, but didn't win. I'll give a shiny penny to anyone who could tell me what won the Oscar for Best Song, what it lost to. You'll all know it. It was The Way We Were, as sung by Barbara Streisand.
Mistake. I demand a recount.
Yeah. He did music for another spy film in the 80s, which was Spies Like Us with Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd. I don't think he's played that one in any concerts since. But yeah, it's an amazing song, not just because of the sort of pyrotechnics musically as much, but content-wise, you know, he's asked to do this by the producers. George Martin turns up with an acetate and they go, all right, when are you going to deliver the finished thing? This is Paul. We just wanted him to write it. So you were going to turn down Paul McCartney for the film? And they're like, no, this is it. It's like, okay, that worked out all right. But it's content-wise, it's not actually got one verse, chorus, a middle bit, and then half the first verse again. It's very sparse, but somehow very, very good for what it does. Got to number 9 in the UK, got to number 2 in America as well. So, again, more sales over there. Now, we're jumping forward a little bit now to the 80s and coming up. So, again, I ask you, do you know the studio version or the live version mainly?
The studio version of this.
Excellent, yeah. So this is another strange case where in America the live version on the flip side of the single was promoted more than the actual studio version, which was an odd thing because of the way that this, you know, just to do with plugging and promotion type stuff. But either way, you know, it gets to number one on the Billboard Hot 100, you know, number two here, and it was a real sort of return to chart form for Paul. So what is it about coming up? And this is, because this is such a different one to the ones we've talked about before.
This one has, well, it suits the title, doesn't it? Coming up, the music. And it has a kind of delight and sense of absurdity. Mm-hmm. I think it's playing a little bit on its own cliché-ness, but it also is into it. So it's clever in it. The music gives you the feeling that the words are offering, but it's also aware of its it seems it's winking. This is one of Paul's winking songs. And he's winking throughout about the emotion, but he's also owning it. And that's, I think everyone who hears it hears the wink and the ownership, and that's brilliant.
Yeah, and I think nowhere is that demonstrated better than in the video for it, where he's playing all the different sort of dress-up characters of his own sort of career.
It's a great video.
Yeah, it's wonderful, yeah.
Where he's 7 or 12 people, and the only person who isn't him in the video is Linda, who's also being very playful and ridiculous.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, especially him being 1964 Paul in doing the woos.
Yeah.
One of the wonderful things about coming up, which I remember the first time I heard the McCartney 2 album, that took me by surprise. But well, yeah, one of the wonderful things about it is that this is a song that made John Lennon go, that's great. He's doing something different. I want to start recording more. I mean, the tragedy obviously being that we're talking about 1980 and he wasn't going to get the chance to do much more. But again, it's a self-produced Paul one. It's another one. Leave him alone with a multi-track and a load of synthesizers in this case. And he just keeps layering and chopping and erasing and putting stuff back on and doing it. But then he takes it out on tour and we end up with a live version. So I've got another, see if you can spot the join moments here. Yeah.
that I got a future.
Yeah. So unlike the Maybe I'm Amazed, the live version of this is much faster as well. So fast you can hear the brass players are almost falling off the stage trying to keep up with the little runs. I mean, Lennon's theory was that the sort of American promoters pushed that was because that's Paul's natural voice, whereas the studio version is him fiddling with the dial, making it all sort of weird and very speeded there as well. So we're into the 1980s there with coming up. And then we cap it off with... I mean, it's not technically a Paul McCartney song. And I am absolutely fascinated to see why you've chosen The Girl Is Mine by Michael Jackson and Paul McCartney.
Okay, I want to say that Paul is the one who makes that song great.
Yeah.
That with Michael Jackson, it's a good song, a little bit of a simple song. But Paul's humor and playfulness with his collaborator... make that song really, really good.
Yeah.
So I give PM the credit, not only because I like him better, but because I think he deserves it in this context. He's really having fun.
Yeah.
And the competition he generates with Michael Jackson in every way. So he's competing for the girl. He's competing musically. He's upping the game.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. I mean, I think one of the things to remember is if we're talking about a song from Thriller, we know that Thriller becomes essentially the biggest album of all time ever. And Michael Jackson at the time ends up being seen as one of the world's greatest singers, you know. And on this track, you've got Paul McCartney keeping up with him, if not overtaking him, in the singing stakes for a song that he didn't write.
I think so.
And spent, you know, he was probably in the studio, I think probably, well, it only took a couple of days to record. Wow. And But yeah, it's a good point about the humour of it. Does everyone know The Girl Is Mine, the Michael Jackson song? I mean, it was a big hit in America. It got to like number two in the charts and number one on the R&B charts. Number eight over here. Spent quite a while in the charts. It has kind of been forgotten, I think, in the history of even sort of Michael Jackson's big singles, because it's not Thriller from Thriller, you know. Quincy Jones production. I don't know if everyone saw what Quincy Jones said about the Beatles a couple of years ago. I'm not going to use the rude word. They were the worst musicians in the world, he said, on the Beatles to the New Yorker. They were no playing MFers. Paul was the worst bass player I ever heard, and Ringo, don't even talk about it.
Wow.
That's Quincy Jones who produced this song. He did later recant it, apparently. I think he said he was misquoted, but yeah. It feels pretty... he was having a grumpy day that day. Poor old Quince. But I'll play a little bit of it. This is what I mean. You said raw to smooth. This is the smooth end of the spectrum.
I don't understand the way you think. Saying that she's yours, not mine. Sending roses and your silly dreams. Really just a waste of time. Because she's mine.
Yeah, it's quite weird to look back on something with Michael Jackson now.
Yes, it's a controversial choice.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because obviously he did some songs that they did together in a more collaborative sense as well, and then he pulled the sort of legal rug out from under Paul McCartney by buying all the songs, which is, you know, this song represents that sort of period where it's like they're having a great time as friends and collaborators. And you know, Paul said to him, you know what you want to do? you want to look after your future, buy some publishing rights.
Wow.
Not mine. Yeah, that's just about sorted itself out in McCartney's favour, but there's a non-disclosure thing on the recent thing, so we just don't know how much he paid. But I don't know if you know the Flowers in the Dirt album by Paul McCartney. where he collaborates with Elvis Costello, and he does a song on that called You Want Her Too, which is it's the same concept, essentially, just Elvis Costello is a slightly more acerbic voice than Michael Jackson ever was. And yeah, the backing band on The Girl Is Mine is essentially Toto as well, which is a really interesting thing I didn't know about at all. So was it? Do you remember this being a big song at the time? Because like I say, it was huge in the charts.
Huge. Yeah. In the United States, it was massive.
Yeah.
And what made it work was there's banter toward the end.
Yes.
Not sure how spontaneous it is, but they're funny together.
I mean, you're already in a song where one of the key words is doggone. And there can't be many songs that rely on the word doggone. This is perhaps famous for Michael. We're not going to fight about this, okay?
Yeah.
I think I told you before, I'm a lover, not a fighter. I'm not doing any voices, by the way. I heard it all before, Michael. She told me that I'm her forever lover, you know, don't you remember? It can't be being done seriously. It's so, the tongue firmly in cheek. But yeah, it's interesting. So that's a really interesting selection. I think there is an interesting US slant to that there that perhaps if I'd have asked other people, they perhaps wouldn't have thought of some of those choices as their desert island.
Consistent with my barbaric accent.
Oh, yes, terrible, terrible. All right, suppose in the true Desert Island Discs format, if you had to save one of them, which one would you save?
Clear answer.
Go on.
Maybe I'm Amazed.
Yeah.
Well, Paul, thank you very much. Cass, thank you very much. I'm delighted to see we have three choices in common of your five.
Wow.
Yeah, the same version of Maybe I'm Amazed. Also coming up, and also Live and Let Die, that would be the one. Yeah, again, live as well. So first of all, thank you very much to Paul and to Cass for taking the time.
Thank you.
So thank you very much indeed.
Well, there's some great choices in there.
There was, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that struck me there with his choices, considering he's not kind of decade restricted like we are in this series.
No,
is within those five choices, you get a real idea of the kind of breadth of McCartney's work, don't you? I mean, you don't get much different than The Girl Is Mine and Live and Let Die.
Yeah, no, they are definitely different types of things. It's interesting, though, that these five songs show quite a difference in the types of things McCartney can do, but they're by no means the extreme examples because, you know, there's another bunch of decades worth of music of him trying things out. And there's stuff like the Fireman albums and the electronic stuff he's done, you know, properly extreme end of stuff.
Yeah.
Even if this seems like a big wide range, it's still only a sort of slice of McCartney anyway.
And I guess that, even though it's even within someone's top five where you've distilled all of his more fringe stuff down to someone's best picks, you still have such a range of in there, and I guess you always kind of would with McCartney because there's no such thing really as like middle of the road McCartney. There's this more commercial stuff,
which is funny because he has been accused of being very middle of the road, and obviously that can only work at a certain time, because the road changes direction and shape a lot.
Yeah, it's so, like saying someone's middle of the road for a period of 5 years out of a career spanning, well, I don't know how long now,
a long time.
At least 60 years, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now? If he's 80, he's over 60 years worth of music. Yeah. Yeah, that's it's great. I mean, the only one I wasn't familiar with of the five was Coming Up. I've never heard it, never heard of it.
Oh, and people will be sighing at you.
Well, they're allowed to. I mean, this is the point of this, isn't it? I'm not the expert, really, especially with the solo stuff. So it's a discovery for me. But that one's never come my way. And I'm guessing, because I think you said in the interview about where it charted, that it's going to be in our series at some point.
No, it's not, because it's in the 80s for McCartney.
Oh, it's
not
80s.
Straight into the 80s.
Well, I thought we were just at the end of the 70s.
No, let me...
Because you mentioned Lennon kind of picking up on it.
Yeah, but that was in 1980.
Okay,
you know,
so it's
outside the boundaries for this season of the Big Beatles Sort Out, which is a shame because it's such a brilliant song.
Oh, well, it's a shame because I've had a good listen now a couple of times, and I wasn't going to say too much about it, thinking we'll get to talk about it. But it's the thing that interested me about that is how that's the one that got Lennon interested, and it's strange because it is kind of 80. You can tell it's definitely.
He's got a certain synths that make certain sounds.
And a certain way of playing those synths. with short stubby riffs and things, and it's really interesting hearing the difference between, because which was the version that Cass was.
So with Coming Up, he knew the studio version.
Yeah, which is like very affected on his voice, isn't it? Like,
yeah, he's doing a lot of vary speeding on his voice, yeah, so you get these very strange McCartney sounds, as opposed to the live version, which was on the flip side and then was pushed more in the States.
Yeah.
And became supposedly the bigger hit over there, where it's, you know, it's his normal voice that you can hear. It's sort of rocking out Wings Stadium McCartney.
Mm. It's really interesting. I would probably agree definitely on Maybe I'm Amazed and Live and Let Die. Would probably be, you know, if I was to do a Macca Top 5 from what I know currently, which is expanding with every episode we do, I definitely think that, you know, Maybe I'm Amazed and Live and Let Die, they kind of go without saying for me because they're just so good. And I do very much like Uncle Albert too.
Yeah, I do. I love it.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'd put it ahead of Band on the Run or Another Day, or seeing as we're unrestricted by decade, I put it there, would probably be up there for me, because not only is that one of my favourite McCartney songs, it's probably one of my favourite ever songs.
Yeah, Put It There is one of those little hidden gems on an album that doesn't get enough love. Flowers in the Dirt definitely doesn't get enough love.
But it just goes to show, this there are always going to be a few, I think, that probably average out on a lot of people's lists, but then it's kind of, there's just so much to go at, isn't there?
Yeah. I did think it was interesting that, of course, because, you know, growing up in America, living in America, Cass knows the live version of Maybe I'm Amazed as the big hit, because it was.
Mm.
I played an extract in that there, comparing the tempos of the two.
Yes, it's really different. I mean, it's a huge swing downwards, isn't it? A downswing in BPM.
But we can't talk about this because the live single of Maybe I'm Amazed will crop up at some point in the Big Beatles Sort Out.
Ah, yes. Which is interesting because I wasn't entirely sure it was going to until hearing.
Well, I'd sort of toyed with leaving it out of the list because I wasn't quite sure about its status. Mm. But yeah, it did chart over here, so we are going to talk about and its B-side.
And that's great. That's what we need. It's a great song. There's just so much to go at, isn't there? I mean, I think he acknowledged this in his choices, that the most of the controversial choice or interesting choice is The Girl Is Mine.
Yeah, which isn't a McCartney song. It's a Michael Jackson song.
But it's...
Paul McCartney.
With Paul McCartney. He's a heavily featured artist on it, isn't he? Yeah. But I mean, I used to listen to that. When I used to go to college in my early 20s, when I was doing my music tech diploma, me and my friend who I used to travel up there with had Thriller on tape.
Right.
In his car. We had Thriller and I think Argus, or no, by Wishbone Ash, or maybe that was someone else. No, we definitely had Thriller, and we listened to that a lot, and on it was The Girl Is Mine.
Yeah.
Which, even though I think in our early 20s, we were too young and self-important to realise the tongue-in-cheekness of it.
Yeah, it's easy to take the mickey out of it, because if you don't...
Full cheese,
you know, there's no way McCartney could have been doing that seriously. I can just imagine the look, him giving the look across the microphone.
Yeah.
Really. But yeah, it's been used as a stick to beat him with, I think, now and then.
But when you have to think, it really changes the complexion of that song, thinking he's aware of this, of the silliness. Because if you don't, it is just weird cheese, isn't it? But it's a good song. And even though we used to take the mickey out of it, we never used to fast forward it. You know, you'd still listen to it all the way through, and you can't argue that it's not musically a great song. I always used to do the impression of the After Loving Me, You Can Never Love Another. it's great to have some different stuff in there, from considering that the catalogue available.
It was an interesting choice given Michael Jackson's status and reputation these days.
Mm.
But I'm glad that Cass picked it and had a very good reason for doing so. You know, a good way to celebrate McCartney as a singer in the 80s in a particular scenario that he's often not in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I thought it was a great interview. And as you said before we listened to it, great to get another perspective on these things, given that this show is primarily me kind of spouting my ill-formed Beatle-based opinions kind of all over the shop. So it's nice to have someone's probably better formed opinions replacing them for a little while. Thank you, Paul, for going and doing that.
That's all right. I enjoyed it very much. I was very pleased to be asked. And yeah, interesting, out of all those, the five he picked, What do we got here?
Doggone songs we got.
Doggone. Only the live single of Maybe I'm Amazed and Live and Let Die will be on our list. Because yeah. Uncle Albert, Admiral Halsey, is not a single in the UK.
No.
So there you go.
Yeah, I just know it from the album. And thanks to all, like you've already said, thanks to all the people who offered to, you know, allowed our podcast to be the vehicle for this.
Yeah.
And I would just go further just to say, how many hours of podcasts about Beatles do we have to log before we get honorary masters?
I don't need one. I've got a master's.
About the Beatles.
Oh, right, yes.
Yours broadly covers it, doesn't it? Popular music. What's yours?
What, are you suggesting that I am a jack of all trades, master of none? Well, I am. I'm a master of arts.
Well,
you can't take that away from me. But I didn't really write much about the Beatles in my master's at all, really.
Fair enough. No, I'm sure the people who graduated have done a lot more complex things than just making up some numbers every week to deserve their masters.
Yeah.
But it's really good to you know, for it to be getting, to continue to get, and to be getting the academic focus it deserves.
Yeah, definitely.
As an area of study, because it's such an area of cultural importance and reflects so much of social sciences, I imagine, is all in there. So all good.
Yeah.
And thanks for the opportunity. And you did a great job, Paul.
Thank you.
Is there anything else you want to talk about that before we give maybe a little nod to next week?
No, I'm done now. I think we just need to whet people's appetites for a thing that we've already whetted their appetites for, I think.
Well, just a double whet people's appetites. Double whet people's appetites. Yes, next week is our Christmas episode, but it is also just a normal episode because we've very cleverly taken the five Christmas songs that appeared over the 70s for the solo Beatles as part of their catalogue, as their singles, releases or B-sides, and put them all in one episode so we can deal with them all in one festive feast of
Festive swoop.
Yes, so we'll be doing that next week, which should get you all in the mood or otherwise for Christmas.
Yeah.
We shall see. So, until then, bye-bye, Beatles.
Best Beatles to you.